So they say I will be one until my dying day. Everything's a fight, a world of fuss. Let your guard down, you turn to rust because it's so much bitter when you know.
By the way it couldn't be. so it seems. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's locked the door and took the key. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, boy, you sure took me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. But when I think of you, I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep dry. Gotta stop believing in all your lies. Cause there's too much to do before I die. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. It's today. Can't get up yet, and so I'm here to stay. Till someone comes along and takes my place with a different name, yes, a different face. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright.
Okay, this is WGXC Accra 90.7 The Wave Farm Music in conversation, of course, for open ears. You have just listened to the first track with something from myself, Spaghetti Eastern Music. It's a song called Time for Letting Go. It's from an album called Sketches of Spam. And after that, that will be a hint for you all. That was a song called Feeling All Right. A classic of the classic rock vernacular, written by Dave Mason, recorded by Traffic, and that's who's going to be here today, Dave Mason. This is Reading is Functamental. It is a monthly show where I speak to folks who've written books about musicians, and often they're musicians themselves, like today's guest, Dave Mason. As for myself, my name is Sal Cataldi. I am a musician. I play in a bunch of local bands up here, Spaghetti Eastern Music, The Vapor Vespers, Guitars A Go-Go, Space Heater. And I'm also a writer. I wrote a lot about music and books about music. I review them for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, New York State Music, and Inside and Out, Upstate New York, and Pop Matters. So tonight, today, this afternoon, or whenever you digitally listen to this thing, we are going to be speaking with Dave Mason, an incredible songwriter and also an incredibly underrated guitar player. He was, of course, a founding member of the great band Traffic. He was kind of in and out of there three times, according to my count. He was there on the first album, left shortly before their U.S. tour, was invited back to the second album because they were short on songs, and he's always long on songs, and then they fired him before the second album came out. He came back for an album called Welcome to the Canteen. He's had an incredible solo career, which kicked off with the album Alone Together, and a really incredible bunch of songs. And one of them, Only You Know and I Know, is the name of his memoir, which just came out this month. He then went on to an incredible solo career, but he was also an incredible collaborator. He collaborated with Delaney and Bonnie. He is featured on Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower, on the Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man. He's all over George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. He made a great collaborative album with Cass Elliott. And recently, he's collaborated with folks like Steve Cropper and Joe Bonamassa. Again, he's a great guitar player. He's currently touring, as he always is, playing songs and entertaining the crowd and talking about his memoir, which is coming out this month. And it's called Only You Know and I Know. And it's a really great book about his life. And we're going to speak to him about it. And thank you for listening. Every month we're here talking to another musician or a great person who wrote a book about a great artist from jazz and rock. So stick around, and here we go with Dave Mason.
Okay. Welcome, Dave Mason. You're one of my favorite songwriters, a incredible and underrated guitarist, and above all, you must be an incredible hang. You're sort of the Zelig of the classic rock era with Delaney and Bonnie and the Dominoes and Hendrix and McCartney and Grand Nash and all those folks. So thanks for joining us and to talk about your memoir.
Yes, thank you.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to begin. I know time is precious, so I am going to jump straight to the music. I'll hear a little bit about your growing up in the country there, and then how you came upon your first axe, the incredible ukulele, where you got it, and what happened to that ukulele.
Well, it was in a trash can in my sister's house in San Diego.
that was the first thing that you kind of played around with musically?
Yeah, kind of.
And then I understand one of my favorite parts of the book is what your mother did with the ukulele, which was, if you want
to, yeah, use it to unstop the toilet.
There you go. That's what they thought about rock and roll. So
they thought about my playing at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's speak about your playing at the time and your playing now, because, you know, I think you're a really great lead guitarist, a very melodic guitarist. You always have a great tone. And I guess that comes from your early influences. You're kind of like Neil Young. You started sort of in the guitar instrumental vein. If you could tell us a little bit about that, your first band.
First band was the Jaguars. Mm-hmm. And pretty much, you know, my whole thing was really the Shadows,
right?
And Shadows, you know, Ventures. Then it was all the band called the Outlaws, mm-hmm. not the one here. Mm-hmm. Rhett Stoller, Chet Atkins, So all instrumental bands. Yeah.
Right. Well, which is a kind of interesting thing because, you know, I've been, as I prepare for this video, you know, I an interview and I had done it. I don't know if you saw, I did a print review of your book which ran last week. Watching, drilling down on YouTube, watching a lot of videos and just, you know, realizing, you know, first and foremost, I think of you as a songwriter, but, you know, guitar and sort of guitar slinging is a big part of what you do. And you seem to be every video I looked at, you were sort of playing a different guitar. You were on a Firebird for a while, you know. So what is your, what are your kind of favorite guitars and maybe even now what you're using now on your board?
Well, my favorite is the Stratocaster.
Ah, me too.
So that's what I use. Mm-hmm. I played a Firebird for a while, but they're just too unbalanced.
Yeah. So
Strat's always been. So I say Strat's always been my. I think is the ultimate design of any guitar.
Yeah, it's a very sleek, like a woman. So a lot of people know you, obviously, for your first great band, which was Traffic. And that kind of came about from sort of hanging on the late night scene there in Birmingham. And I was at the Elbow Room. So where did you kind of hook up with those guys? Tell us a little bit about the beginnings of Traffic.
Well, Capaldi and I had bands before Traffic. Mm-hmm. We had two or three bands. And so we were big Spencer Davis fans. And eventually we would do little gigs up in Birmingham. And eventually met up with Steve at the Elbow Room. Mm-hmm. And that just developed into a sort of hang. You know, we just hang out for when we could for a year and a half or more before Traffic even started. So when we could, we'd sort of hang out together, and we all had pretty eclectic, diverse musical tastes. And that's really how it happened. I mean, it's just getting together and hanging out.
Well, speaking of getting together and hanging out, I should tell you that I am talking to you. I live a quarter of a mile from Big Pink. Up in West Saugerties, and that's gonna divert into the famous Berkshire Cottage where you guys germinated the whole act. So how did that come about? You know, maybe what songs kind of germinated in this period, and what other people kind of came by and hung and jammed and all that stuff.
The cottage was basically, we wanted somewhere we could all, you know, because when Traffic formed, we really had no clue what we were going to do musically. So we needed somewhere to isolate ourselves and figure out what the hell we were going to do. And so that was why we did that, why we finished up just moving to a place like that, or at least having it available to us.
Thank you.
So you were talking about the cottage, and what songs kind of came out of there for the debut album?
Well, pretty much it's on that first album.
Mm-hmm. And that first album kind of sowed the seeds of the destruction, if you will, of the band. The success of your single, Hole in My Shoe?
I guess.
Yeah. So how did that, did you use George Harrison's sitar, gift sitar on that song?
No, I'd already sent for, I had one that was, I'd sent to, George gave me an address where to get a really good one mm-hmm. in India. So I sent for it.
Oh, cool. So what happened is, so you, decided to leave the band on the sort of the eve, I guess, of the first US tour. So, and what were your reasons? Obviously you had an on and off again relationship with the band, but what were the feelings that led you to, you know, to do that really?
Well, that's what I said. That's why I write it in the book. Mm-hmm. I was young. It was just too much too soon for me.
And you were around 19 then?
About 19.
Yeah. And then interestingly, you're back for the second album. You went to Greece Joni Mitchell had a famous time there. Obviously, I think Leonard Cohen also was on Hydra. So you Greece played a role in the creation of some of the songs that were featured on the second album.
Well, it created Feeling All Right and All Joining In, yes.
Yeah, great. And I have to say, my favorite song on that album is Crying to Be Heard. I think the second side of that album is truly classic.
Can't get it.
So how did the, you know, when you write, like, are you the kind of person who it comes out in like a 15-minute spurt, or is it something that you belabor over? So what's your process for really songwriting?
It depends. Mm-hmm. There is, I don't have a process.
Is it that you have to go in the studio when you need 8 songs, or?
No, if I'm going in the studio, I already have the songs.
Yeah. So you don't do what they started to do, I guess, in the 70s is go in the studio with nothing and putter around until you come up with something.
Waste a lot of money.
No. Yeah, waste a lot of money. And then that second album, which is a great album, then you were asked to leave the band around that time, correct?
As it says in the book.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Cool. And then, you know, right around this time, you had 2 famous collaborations with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, most notably, I guess, the Hendrix collaboration. So what was your sort of relationship with Hendrix, and, you know, how did that whole thing with All Along the Watchtower come about?
Well, I pretty much laid it out in the book exactly how it happened. Sort of asking me redundant questions here.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what we're trying to do is I'm trying to tell. I already reviewed the book, so you know my thoughts.
Well, I don't want to give away. You know, it's like read the book if you want to know what happened, folks. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well. Okay. So, but again, you were good mates with Jimmy, as it says in the book.
And well, we met up in the album, I think Blazes or somewhere. Mm-hmm. I just mutual admiration. I liked his music. He was a Traffic fan.
Right.
And we developed a little relationship musically and that developed into, fortunately, me being asked to play on some of his sessions.
Right.
I.e. Watchtower and also I did a few tracks with him playing sitar and bass, because I was going to take Noel Redding's place at one point.
Oh wow, great. And you also
that never materialized.
Yeah. And you also, there were some interesting things about bands that were potentially a collaboration with Ginger Baker was one.
After Cream broke up, we basically, myself, Ginger Baker, and a fellow named Bobby Gass, bass player, tried to put a band together called Salt.
And was
which was too much like, which obviously I was, for me, it was like, man, this is, no, this is going to be, all people are going to do is like an attempt to be Cream again. So,
right. Yeah. Which is something that, obviously Eric didn't want to do. And then, you were more of a song person, although, you know, you have the chops to do that, obviously. Then you moved to LA, which kind of supercharged your career, you know, hooking up with Delaney and Bonnie. And through them, that led to collaborations with George and, you know, nearly being in Derek and the Dominoes. You wrote there.
Well, George and McCartney, I already had spent time with and knew before I moved to America.
Right.
So that was already ongoing, you know, had been ongoing. Mm-hmm. Delaney Bonnie for me, the whole move to America was about getting close to the source. You know, the British invasion is an American story. It was just copy what came from America, put our own spin on it, and sell it back to you all.
Yeah, there you go.
All rock and roll and all contemporary music is born in America.
Yeah.
So I came here and met up with Delaney and Bonnie, and just fantastic band, great singers. And they had a big, huge, huge hit with Only You Know and I Know.
Right.
And then we went out and toured with the Open Up to Blind Faith shows, which is how Eric got to finish up taking most of that band.
Right. Yeah. How did you, what was your, what degree? I know that you played a show or two with them, and did a little bit of studio stuff, but
I was going to be in the band. Yeah. Domino when they started. Yes.
Well, you dodged a bullet there. You know, actually, I just spoke to, I don't know if you know Joel Selvin. He's a great rock writer, and he just did a book, a really fantastic book about Jim Gordon, who you played with when you returned to Traffic for Welcome to the Canteen. So
I was with Jim Gordon long before that. Jim Gordon's on Alone Together.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, and that let's get to that. I mean that.
Jim Gordon was one of the in and out drummers for Delaney and Bonnie.
Right.
Him, Jim Keltner, and a little guy named Jimmy Carstein.
Yeah.
With the go-to drummers for Delaney and Bonnie. Well, so I knew all.
Yeah. Well, that album is really it's a favorite around our house. When we moved up here to West Saugerties from New York City, you know, we brought out the old vinyl. And that's one of them. And it's such a classic album, the selection of songs. World and Changes is one of my favorites. So that's like that goes into waltz time, that change. Is that three quarter time?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So and then interestingly enough, I was listening yesterday to you did a re-record of that album in 2020, which has a little bit more of a sort of a country vibe. There's some banjo on it. There seems to be some mandolin.
Well, there's banjo on the original one too.
Oh yeah. It just seems much more, it seems a bit more country. So what was it like to kind of go and recreate something you had done probably 50 years before?
Well, it was fun. I mean, I played a lot of those songs live in the shows for years. So, and since the master tapes for Alone Together got destroyed in the fire at Universal, for one reason or another, I just thought, you know what? I had put that new version of World and Changes together just for fun. And then thought, you know what? I could just redo this. Let me just do it, record it. And so I had finished up having all the tracks. I mean, most of it I cut live in the studio in one afternoon. So I decided to recreate the album out of it, basically.
And was that your sort of your live band that did that? Your touring band?
It was at the time, yes.
Yeah.
to me, I'll tell the truth, 'cause I can't pretend. Oh, find yourself a real friend, but then you nearly reach the end of all of this running round with you.
Well, then you had a great run in following that in the 70s, and with a high point with the Let It Flow album with We Just Disagree being your big hit there. So what was it like? How crazy were the 70s in touring and with all those?
How crazy
bands?
Were the 60s. How crazy were the 70s? How crazy were the 80s?
Yeah.
How crazy were the 90s?
Yeah. Well, it seems from your book, you know, that there was plenty of crazy. There were some unfortunate, I guess, contracts that were signed. Let's say you had sort of an issue with Blue Thumb after Alone Together, and do you feel that how the business has changed? Is it more to your liking?
Your audio's going out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, how do you feel the business has changed? Do you like it more now than versus the 60s? It's a little more of a DIY thing now.
Everybody's stealing it.
Yes. That's interesting.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hello.
I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello. Hello.
Yeah. Everybody's stealing everything, and Spotify and the rest of them don't pay the right royalties.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on.
Yeah.
So all we're left with is live.
Yeah.
It becomes somewhat of a exercise in futility, to be honest with you, which I hate to keep saying, making an album.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody out there. One of the biggest things is no radio. There's no DJs anymore. There's no great disc jockeys anymore. There's no radio. It's all just formatted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it frankly, from my point of view, it sucks.
Yeah. Well, I think few people realize
something fun and positive.
No.
The audience out there have no clue about it. They don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm just doing the same thing I did when I was 17 and playing live, you know.
Yeah.
That's what we're left with.
Yeah.
And even live ain't live anymore with a lot of acts.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That is true. And the bigger the act, the bigger the bullshit, right? Well, speaking of big acts, few people, I think, not enough people realize that you were a part of Fleetwood Mac, actually, in the mid-90s. And so how did that come about, and what did you do with that band?
We recorded the album Time. Mm-hmm. And other than that, we just played a lot of shows around the world.
Yeah.
And that was it. It didn't go anywhere. Warner Brothers, nobody really knew there was a new album out. And, you know, Christine McVie did the album, but she didn't want to go. She wouldn't go on the road.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like we were a Fleetwood Mac cover band.
Yeah.
For 2 years.
Yeah. Well, just a couple more questions.
Because I actually have another interview here.
We're going to do this real quick. I just wanted to speak to you about the tour that you're on now, where you're going to be, and, how the book and sort of, are you going to be doing book readings or anything like that to telling stories? Like, how are you going to be promoting the book and the tour?
Well, the book doesn't officially come out until September.
Right.
We just have them on the road with us, so they're available on the road. And basically, I'm out there doing my little traffic jam tour, mm-hmm. which we include a few traffic songs. We have band is super good. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have a new Miss Mark Stein, who originally lead singer and organ player with Vanilla Fudge, is now part of a band. Mm. So Mark's right. doing some great stuff. So yeah, we're just out there playing. I'll be playing until I drop, I guess.
There you go. Well, on that note, we hope you don't drop. We hope you don't drop too soon, and that folks can go online and they can actually pre-order your book. That's why we're talking now.
And, you can do that online, or if you're at the concert, we do have them. We do have them with us at the concerts.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for joining me for this new episode of Reading is Funkdemental is the show. I've talked to musicians like yourself.
Thank you.
And thanks again. And thank you so much for all your music over the years.
You are welcome. And thank you.
Ciao.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
getting all the pain. Footprints in the snow, we're showing the things are still the same. Till you get the one, the sun, or someone.